Next case on the Southern Panel docket is Dustin Barnett versus State of Nevada, case number 61083. Mr. Cornell, Mr. McCarthy, you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right. Go ahead, Mr. Cornell.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court and Mr. McCarthy. My name is Benjamin Cornell. I represent the appellant, Dustin Michael Barnett. If it is agreeable with the court, there were four issues that were raised in this appeal. And although I do not believe there to be a particularly weak one in the bunch, I would like to address them out of the order that they were provided in the briefs. I've sort of grouped them into two categories. On one end, we have issues C and D, I believe, is how they were ordered in the briefs. And those two regard exactly what constitutes the crime of robbery in the state of Nevada. Issues A and B, on the other hand, regard what constitutes an effective waiver of the Fifth Amendment right to silence. So with the court's permission, I'd like to proceed and begin by addressing what was issue C in the brief, having to do with sufficiency of the evidence. To this end, I think what is central to this issue is the standard that's provided in Jackson versus Virginia, United States Supreme Court case. And the standard there is it asks whether the jury, acting reasonably, could have been convinced of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt by the evidence that was properly put before it. Now, I do not wish to spend my time in this argument because I know that it is limited. I don't wish to spend a whole lot of time parroting the facts of this case, but to this end, I think that it's important to briefly discuss what the material facts or the material testimonial facts were, and they were this. There was only one eyewitness to the events that preceded Kim Hanley's death, and that eyewitness was Mr. Dustin Barnett. Mr. Dustin Barnett testified at trial that he made a verbal directive to Kim Hanley to leave the items in question, which was a watch and a large sum of money. He made a verbal directive to Mr. Hanley to leave those items on a coffee table. Mr. Hanley then stood up, removed the watch, threw it at Mr. Barnett, and only then did a firearm become part of the equation. At that point, as we know, Mr. Barnett stood up, he unholstered the gun, held it behind his back, and he would later testify that Hanley swung on him, and eventually the firearm was discharged and killed Hanley. Now, I will be the first to admit these facts are somewhat bizarre. I think that it's safe to say that they are bizarre because Mr. Barnett, as both the appellant and respondent have noted, he was afflicted by PTSD and methamphetamine intoxication at the time of the shooting. However, the fact that the material testimonial facts of this case are bizarre and perhaps somewhat disbelievable does not alter the standard that's provided in Jackson versus Virginia. Now, the state has countered in its briefing that the jury was entitled to disbelieve Mr. Barnett's version of events. And, of course, yes, this is true. Was the jury entitled to dismiss the idea that Mr. Barnett acted in self-defense in any capacity? Indeed, they were. The jury was additionally entitled to dismiss the testimony that the testimony or argument that Mr. Barnett was reasonable in his belief that the items demanded were stolen and that he had some sort of claim of right to them. That is all permissible, that the jury was allowed to disregard these arguments. However, what is not permitted by law is that the jury was allowed to conclude that events unsupported by the evidence are what in fact occurred. The state has stressed throughout this case that Mr. Barnett planned to get the items sought before firing his gun and that he did in fact recover those items after firing his gun. While that sounds like it might be a robbery, it doesn't quite reach the level of what a robbery requires per NRS 200.380. The specific intent element to robbery is missing from that equation there. It was never suggested by any witness in this case, nor was it suggested by any piece of evidence that force or the threat of impending force was a factor in this case before the demand for the money or the watch occurred. That having been said, I'd like to move on to our second issue, which regards what constitutes the crime of robbery in Nevada, and this is the issue having to do with jury instructions. Excuse me for a moment. Now, to this end, the state has asserted that instructions 24 and 26 are not inconsistent with one another because instruction 24 provides that the taking for robbery may simply occur after the victim has died. And while that in itself is true, that is not quite what the instruction said. Had the instruction only said that, that a taking for a robbery may occur after death, we would agree. However, the language of Instruction 24, which is adopted from Leonard v. State, essentially serves to make robbery a general intent crime. To recap here what Instruction 24 says, Instruction 24 says that the taking required for robbery may occur after a victim is deceased, so long as the force or coercion by the defendant for whatever purpose, and that's the language that we stress, for whatever purpose, occurred while the victim was alive and the defendant took advantage of the terrifying situation that he created to take the victim's property. That instruction defines robbery as a general intent crime. What that instruction essentially says is that if you kill somebody for any reason and then take advantage of the situation and help yourself to their property after they've perspired, that's a robbery. And that is entirely incompatible with this court's ruling in Ney v. State, which is what Instruction 26 was based on. Now, I understand that it might be very tempting for this court to look at the statement of laws provided in the appellant's or in the respondent's answering brief and reach a conclusion on the matter on the basis of that statement. Very cleverly, the state wrote in its answering brief that if a defendant shoots a victim and the taking occurs before the shooting, or I'm sorry, excuse me, if the taking occurs after the shooting, then the decision to take the property was made before, and the decision to take the property was made before the use of force, then that allows a conviction for a felony murder. Well, in most circumstances, that statement is true. However, that does not mean that the statement itself is an accurate statement of law. There are hypothetical outliers that defy this statement, and in the briefing here, we've provided examples of those types of outliers. I know that Supreme Court justices and law professors alike are typically loath to hypotheticals, or so I've learned in law school, but if I may propose just one, if we can imagine a scenario where, say, there was an old woman walking through a park and a gentleman jumps out from behind a bush and alarms her and screams in her face and she dies of a heart attack right then and there. If he helps herself to her property after she has died in those circumstances, per Instruction 24, the Leonard versus State instruction, that is a robbery. But we know under the facts of that hypothetical that there was no specific intent that was developed prior to his action of jumping from behind the bush to take the property, and therefore it would be an afterthought robbery, not amounting to a robbery per the Nevada statutes that had occurred consistent with the instruction in Ney versus State. I'd like to move on here to our first two issues, those having to do with waiver and cases such as Michigan versus Mosley and this court's ruling in Dewey. What I would like to emphasize here, as we all know, Michigan versus Mosley provides that the police must scrupulously honor an invocation to the Fifth Amendment right to silence. And what I would like to bring to the court's attention right now is how exactly do we define the term scrupulous? A common meaning dictionary definition of the term scrupulous provides such terms as a careful observation of what is morally right and principled. And what we are contending today is that when the police follow up a clear invocation of the right to remain silent with a request to search, just moments later, ideas of principle and what is morally right are disregarded, if you will. Now, that said, appellant is aware of precedent, even precedent from the United States Supreme Court, which provides that requesting consent to search is not in and of itself an interrogative question. Now, frankly, I tend to disagree with that, but that's besides the point. Nowhere in the case of Michigan versus Mosley is the right to cut off interrogative questioning recognized. The case only speaks of the right to cut off questioning. Now, what exactly that means, this term questioning, whether or not that includes things that may or may not be considered interrogative, that's something that we don't have a crystal clear idea of, which is why we're here today to argue about it, but I will tell you this. Granted, this doesn't regard the Fifth Amendment right to silence, but rather the Fifth Amendment Miranda Edwards right to counsel, but there are at least two federal circuits that choose not to limit Mosley only to the realm of interrogative questioning. Specifically, I'm referring to the Fifth and Eleventh Circuit, which have provided a number of holdings, providing that an equivocal request to cut off questioning. Essentially, it provides a complete bar to any questioning on the matter other than questions which attempt to clarify whether or not an effective waiver has been made. Here, that's not the type of question that was asked. Moments after saying, you know, I don't want to talk about this, the detective left the room in this case, returned minutes later, and asked for consent to search Mr. Barnett's apartment. I'd also like to point out to this end that, there was no written waiver, nor was there an attempt to contact a magistrate to obtain a warrant to search the apartment. And as far as the facts provide, there were no exigencies in this case that would provide as an exception to get a warrant. There was no risk of the destruction of evidence or the spoliation of evidence. Those would have been steps that could have been easily taken by the detectives in this case, and we submit here today that the reason why those steps weren't taken was to attempt to find a way to obtain a consent to search right then and there without fully informing Mr. Barnett of, I suppose, his rights. And of course, all of this happened before the Miranda warning occurred. That having been said, I'd like to remain my final 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, Mr. Cornell.
Thank you very much.
Mr. McCarthy.
Good morning, Justice Hardesty, members of the court. I'm Terry McCarthy, Deputy District Attorney from Washoe County, on behalf of the state. Sometimes what we try to do is find the logical flaw in someone's argument, and sometimes it just jumps right out at you. And I heard it a few minutes ago when it was suggested that robbery is not a general intent crime. Well, it most certainly is. The intent to permanently deprive the owner is not an element of robbery. There seems to be some confusion about what the various instructions concerned. The instructions properly limited felony murder under a robbery theory. It excluded the afterthought robbery. That's correct. And in the hypothetical of the pedestrian scared to death, that probably would not be a felony murder if there was no intent before steal before the act. Those instructions said just that. So that as long as the plan to steal precedes the homicide, the actual asportation may come after. If you shoot the store clerk in the head and thereafter steal his money, that's against the law. You're not allowed to do that. And that's all those instructions said, nothing more. Regarding the invocation, I was interested to see earlier today talking about providing new authorities because I just happened to go looking last night and ran across a Ninth Circuit decision where the suspect being interrogated said, I'd like to go back to my cell now. And the Ninth Circuit said that is not a clear invocation of the right to remain silent. It is an invocation, is an expression of a desire to leave, nothing more than that. That was in Weaver versus Reynolds, 556 Fed 3rd, page 995. I think it's a couple of years, 2009. Here we go. And I tend to agree with that. And so once again, we have the logical flaw that just reached right out at you, where the suggestion was that this defendant had said, I don't want to talk about this. That never happened. He never said that. What he said is, I'd like to leave. And he said that before being warned. And the net effect of that was the officer leaves for a minute, comes back in, says, oh, no, you're not leaving at all. The net effect of that was to remove any ambiguity and make sure he was indeed in custody at that moment for Miranda purposes. That's all. If it was an invocation, it was certainly not a clear invocation. It was at best ambiguous. I suggest it was nothing more than an expression of all things considered, I'd rather be in Philadelphia. It was W.C. Fields' quote, I think. But it certainly was not an invocation of the right to remain silent. If it was, it was honored. So we can see we're starting to get too many ifs in one sentence here, but even if that was an invocation of the right to remain silent, and even if it was a clear invocation, and even if it was, you know, after Miranda, the supposed violation is not interrogation. The supposed violation is asking, can I search your house? The response is not incriminating, no matter what the response is. Yes, you may. No, you may not. If some prosecutor had offered that, the refusal to search, to allow search, as evidence of guilt, you'll pardon me if I don't want to defend that particular course of conduct. So there is no court that has said that following an invocation that the suspect remains, becomes unable to grant consent. The suggestion this court heard is that if there was an invocation of the right to remain silent, and if it was ambiguous or unambiguous, and if it came after the Miranda, that there can be no question of any sort. That would seem to preclude things like booking questions, which just doesn't make sense. I suggest to you the argument here just doesn't make sense. There is no violation of this defendant's right to remain silent by asking, can we search your home? It was not until after that, according to the district court, about 2 hours after that, that there was a break. The officer returns, the suspect is properly Mirandized, and then he gave statements. Only those statements, post-Miranda, were admitted as evidence before the jury. That's not an error. That's the way it's supposed to work. To the suggestion that the only way to get a waiver is by a written waiver, once again, I have to say I'm unfamiliar with the courts that have adopted that ruling, and I wouldn't recommend it. In a recent case, Berquist, I think it was, they said that one waives the right to be silent by speaking. Now, the right to counsel may require something else because it's not self-executing. If one wishes to be silent, one remains silent. If one wishes to speak, one speaks. That court did not require a written waiver, and I don't remember any court that ever has. When, to go into the question of the sufficiency of the evidence, by the defendant's own admission, he applied lethal force, then took money from took the wallet from the corpse and hid it. As long as that notion arose before the application of the force, that's robbery. I'm not sure what the problem here is. There's other elements. You know, the watch, he claimed, well, he was trying to recover what he thought was a stolen watch, but it wasn't. We don't need to get into that. I mean, the court has ruled not too long ago in a rather infamous case that the attempt to recover your own property by force is still robbery. But we don't need to get into that in this case because the evidence by the defendant's own admission is he killed a man and then took his wallet. And he was thinking about it beforehand. He was thinking the victim had showed this money. And it showed the property. This is your dad's watch. And his own weird thought processes, according to the defendant, led him to believe that the money, the watch, some jewelry box, and something else must all have been taken, and therefore he was going to recover them all. Well, he did so by killing somebody with a firearm. That's armed robbery. And it's felony murder. And this court ought to affirm the judgment. I'm not sure I really understand the argument about the relative timing because it was there. By the defendant's own admission. So he purposely planned to take property, then he applied deadly force, and then he took the property. That's robbery, and that's felony murder. And I find myself once again running out of things to say here, so I'll just exercise my right to be silent unless the court has any questions.
Any questions for Mr. McCarthy? No, thank you. All right. Mr. Cornell, you have 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. My understanding of robbery has always been that a robbery is a taking that's accompanied by the specific intent to deprive somebody of property by force or by the threat of immediate force. This is something that I'll look into surely when I return back to Reno from Carson City, but my understanding runs contrary to Mr. McCarthy's. And again, I will emphasize that the material testimonial facts of this case provide that there was no threat of force that came prior to the taking, which occurred here. Now, as to whether or not Mr. Barnett made a clear invocation of the Fifth Amendment right to silence, I will first note that the district court made a finding in his favor on that topic. The district court found that he did, in fact, make a clear invocation. And I believe that his words were, I would rather not speak. This, of course, happened, or no, I believe that his words were, I'm sorry, I would rather leave, yes. This, of course, happened after he was told that he was free to leave several times until the point where he said, yes, I would rather leave. And then, he was not permitted to leave. But as to the question of whether or not that was a clear invocation of the right to remain silent, I would like to bring to this court's attention two cases that were cited in the reply brief. That would be United States versus Rodriguez, which is found at 518 F3rd 1071, Ninth Circuit case, as well as Arnold versus Reynolds 321 F3rd 859. Those cases provide examples of where the Ninth Circuit found and did not find a clear invocation of the right to remain silent. We can see there that the words no comment as to do you have anything to say was found to be a sufficiently clear and unambiguous invocation, and the words I'm good for tonight were found not to be. Understanding the holdings of those two cases, I will submit that I would rather leave after being asked if he would like to leave and saying yes, I would rather leave, is clear enough to establish that Mr. Barnett was invoking his right to remain silent and not merely stating that he would rather be elsewhere. As to the topic of booking questions that Mr. McCarthy raises, I will submit that booking questions are more administrative in nature, and especially considering that those are questions that happen after somebody has already been arrested. I think that's the big thing to focus on here. In this case, Mr. Barnett had not yet been arrested, and we were still in the investigatory side of the proceedings and not the administrative side. He was asked if he had not yet been arrested and was asked if he would give consent to search his apartment. I think that that's quite different than booking questions that happen at the police station. On the topic of that there was a two-hour gap. If we are not considering the request for consent to search to be a reinitiation of questioning, then I guess we look at the two-hour gap that Mr. McCarthy spoke about, and that's the gap between before the search and after the search, when the detectives came back and spoke to him. And while the gap was 2 hours in length, I will note that in United States versus Sue, the Ninth Circuit clarified that the time elapsed in between the two rounds of questioning and the subject matter of the second round are not of the primary importance in making determinations based off of Mosley versus Michigan. Relying on Sue, this court ruled in Dewey that what is more important are that the second set of warnings are careful and repeated and that the a written waiver accompanied the second set of warnings. Here we had no written waiver. And furthermore, the second set of warnings were not carefully explained, and he never received a written set of warnings. Those warnings, instead, were prefaced with a statement of, well, we just came back from the search, and we've taken a look around, and I really want to believe you, and this could be a justifiable homicide, it could be manslaughter, but I need your help, but first I have to Mirandize you. That's the way it was prefaced here. I don't think that was very carefully made on the detective's end. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your briefs in this case and your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted and will be in recess.